Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
And now, please welcome author Ron Chernow and moderator Roy Eisenhart to the Commonwealth Club stage.
Thanks, folks. Welcome. Well, we're in the room where it happened.
I can't escape a certain show.
Well, I want to repeat the welcome to you, Ron, and to our audience. We're really looking forward to having an hour or so talking. Oddly, not about Alexander Hamilton, but about your newer book, Ulysses S. Grant. And those of you who want to get an autographed copy of this afterwards, if you haven't purchased it beforehand, you can talk and go outside and get a forklift and and bring it down and
Roy,
run.
I've gone through every heavy book joke in my time.
Well, Doris Kearns Goodwin beat you out with her Taft to Roosevelt book. But and let me say one other thing about this program, because it's really important. It's because of the Bernard Osher Foundation that this Good Lit series is presented. So I really want to thank them for their financial support of this tonight. Naturally, you'll be paid in Confederate dollars, but other than that, it's all right. Grant, I went into reading this thinking about Grant just as a Civil War general who was successful by basically having so many Confederate soldiers killed that they finally capitulated. And I came away from it with a completely 180-degree impression. And indulge me for a minute. I'm not going to do a lot of talking, but I want to read something, if I can find my glasses. Otherwise, I'll have you read it. You read it. Can you read it? This is from the government, our government, whitehouse.gov website, right?
I know what you're about to read.
You know where I'm going.
It's disgraceful.
Right. No. Okay, so you lay the foundation, and there's the exact quote at the bottom there.
Yeah, this appears on the White House website about U.S. Grant. When he was elected, the American people hoped for an end to turmoil. Grant provided neither vigor nor reform. Looking to Congress for direction, he seemed bewildered. One visitor to the White House noted, quote, a puzzled pathos as of a man with a problem before him of which he does not understand the terms. I think it's safe to say that every single word in this quote is incorrect.
Right.
I hope we'll be retired forever by this book.
Well, I think that's a, And maybe we'll send him a copy of the recording of this talk. But so let's start there. This historical stereotype of Grant as the butcher, the drunkard, the inept president, the corrupt president. You take that on, and let's take the big frame of your book and talk about how you address that.
Yeah, well, you know, when I started this this book, there were really, you know, three chief myths that I wanted to retire. You know, number one was the image of Grant as a hopeless drunkard stumbling his way through the Civil War in a kind of alcoholic haze. The second myth that I wanted to retire, that he was a crude and brutal butcher as a general who won purely by dint of hurling tens of thousands of, you know, hapless young soldiers against the enemy. And then the third stereotype was that his was a failed two-term presidency that was marred by scandals and corruption, nepotism, and cronyism. And I tried to kind of run all through, you know, three of those themes through the book.
Right. And so develop Grant for us, I mean, as a person. He starts off in a relatively impoverished background, right? And so the first part of his life you capture so well in the book. Give us a thumbnail of that.
Well, I mean, he was born in 1822. He was born in the rural southwest corner of Ohio, about an hour outside of where Cincinnati is today. And he grows up, it's a very beautiful bucolic area, and he grows up in a very, very interesting borderland because he's born literally paces from the Ohio River, and the Ohio River separates, on the one hand, the free state of Ohio from the slave-owning state of Kentucky. This, you can imagine, is very, very important for someone who was going to become the symbol of North-South reconciliation, and he's straddling these two worlds, and he's so straddling these two worlds that the Grants were ardent abolitionists, but he marries into the Dent family, their slave-owning family in Missouri. So long before the firing on Fort Sumter, Ulysses S. Grant is fighting his own private civil war between, on the one hand, his overbearing abolitionist father and his no less overbearing slave-owning father-in-law. And as you'll see, the relationship between the Dents and the Grants, you know, like the Hatfields and the McCoy look tame in comparison. In fact, the Grants felt so strongly about Ulysses marrying into a slave-owning family that the entire Grant family boycotted the wedding of Ulysses and Julia Grant in St. Louis in 1848, and the Grants really never totally accepted Julia, which was a sore point with Grant. So it's interesting. So he doesn't, Grant, by his own admission, doesn't start out as a hero on the slavery issue, and yet gradually he becomes a hero. One of my favorite lines in the book, Walt Whitman describing Grant, says, "Nothing heroic and yet the greatest hero," and somehow that captures an essential truth about Grant.
Yeah. You mentioned Julia. Let's fill that in a little bit, because she's quite an important person in his life.
Yeah, and I described, you know, Grant's, I should give a brief description of his parents. His father, Jesse Root Grant, was a very avaricious tanner. He was a windbag of a man. He was one of these kind of self-promoting types that were very common on the frontier. And his mother, Hannah, was a very pious, a very prim and self-effacing. And as I say in the book, Jesse Root Grant never seemed to stop talking, and Hannah Grant never seemed to start. But one thing that they both had in common was that this was a very, very repressed household. It was a Methodist household that frowned on dancing, drinking, card playing. In other words, anything that could be vaguely considered fun was kind of outlawed in the Grant house. But there was there were no displays of warmth or physical affection, particularly noticeable with Hannah Grant. And so I think what happens when Grant meets in St. Louis Julia Dent, Julia was very vivacious and openly displayed affection. And it's interesting, you know, in all of the comments that I collected from the Grant family, how offended they were by the fact that she would be physically, you know, emotionally affectionate with him, whereas poor Grant, you can imagine, was really, you know, parched, you know, growing up in this very arid household. And just give you a little bit of a flavor of their marriage, because this was a very, very happy marriage. People said that they were very much well into the marriage, almost like a teenage couple, that they would sit there in the corner holding hands together. Julia was not a raving beauty, and she had an eye condition called the strabismus, which would be a squint eye, a lazy eye. And she was so self-conscious about this slight cross eye that even when she was first lady, she would always insist upon taking pictures in profile. Well, one of my favorite stories in the book is that during the Civil War, by which point Grant had become a general and a well-known general, he sees her one day, and Julia says that she has consulted a doctor to see whether this eye problem could be surgically corrected, and he's quite flabbergasted. And he says to her, why would you have gone and done that? And she said, oh, Ulysses, that was her nickname. She said, oh, Ulysses, I'm such a plain little wife, and you've become such a great man. She felt self-conscious about it. And so Ulysses said to her, did I not see and fall in love with these same eyes? And he said, I never want you to touch them again. And no Hollywood screenwriter could have improved on that one. Really kind of pretty romantic line. And it's interesting, because usually when you write about, you know, such a famous figure as Grant, there's usually scuttlebutt, you know, around the edges about affairs and different things like that. Whereas the Grant story, particularly given that there was so much gossip about the drinking, but no gossip in terms of Grant having a roving eye. It was a real love match.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, men of power are rarely monogamous, and he was.
And again, I think that it had a lot to do with the fact that he was emotionally starved in some way, and he really needed Julia. And sometimes, I mean, there's a certain kind of a bashful man who needs that unconditional love and support. If I can tell, you know, one other favorite story about her. Grant goes through repeated failure before the Civil War, to the point where he's drummed out of the army in 1854 because of a drinking episode. He then tries farming in St. Louis, fails at that. He ends up selling firewood on street corners in St. Louis. One Christmas, he has to pawn his watch in order to buy gifts for his wife and four children. And during this terrible period, and he's crafted a log house for them that he calls Hardscrabble, during this terrible period of failure, Julia has a dream one night. And it's a dream that Ulysses is going to be president of the United States. And when she tells friends and family about this, they will laugh. Nothing could have seemed more preposterous. He was just struggling to support his family and selling firewood on street corners.
So his career really started when he was able to take command of a regiment in the western part of western region of the Civil War. And at first, it was divided. There was the Army of Potomac and then the Western. And he got in there. What struck me, and I'd like you to comment on it, is how much backbiting there was among the various Union generals as he tried to, as he would be successful and they'd criticize him and Halleck would, et cetera. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, there was a tremendous amount of backbiting and malice and competition. And, you know, this is where the drinking issue comes in, you know, not only the reality of it, but, you know, the imaginary issues too. But, you know, there's a wonderful new edition of Grant's papers. It's been done over the last 40 years. It has 50,000 documents. And when I started doing the book, you know, recent books about Grant that have been admiring of Grant have argued that the entire drinking issue was completely overblown and that these were stories invented by malicious rivals. And there was a very active, you're right, it was a very active rumor mill. There were both a lot of anonymous and also signed letters being sent to Abraham Lincoln, Secretary of War Edwin Stanton, etc. And when I started doing the book and I started reading all of these letters, I too had suspected that I would say that these letters were just being invented whole cloth. But what I noticed was that the letters were written by different people at different times in different places, and written, in other words, by people who could not possibly have coordinated their letters or consulted each other. And the description of Grant when he was drinking was perfectly consistent. There was not a single letter, for instance, that ever described Grant as an angry drunk or a violent drunk. And the language was often startlingly similar, that he was silly drunk, idiotically drunk, foolishly drunk. Again, this kind of very tightly buttoned up man. You know, when he would drink, there was like this jovial personality would come out. And he would slur his words and he would start to stumble about. And I began to, quite contrary to my initial expectations, say, you know what, this all seems to be describing the same man with remarkable consistency. So where I had expected to completely dismiss all of these letters, I said that to myself, even though they may well have been sent by people, you know, who were trying to do damage, even if, you know, in the most underhanded way of sending these kinds of malicious letters, it also began to occur to me that, and they may have been embroidered and exaggerated in different ways, but that there was certainly a core of truth because it was always describing the same character. But I was absolutely, as you apparently were, astonished by just how much backbiting there was going on. It's really
awful.
Quite ugly.
Yeah. I mean, as opposed to the Confederacy, where Lee was venerated, Johnson was venerated, and there was...
Well, there's great, you know, great line in the book where... because Grant was always being asked, what do you think of Robert E. Lee? And he certainly respectively as a general, though he did think that he was overrated as general. How could he not? And he did beat him. He not only beat Lee, he encircled his army and captured it. But he has a wonderful line in one of his interviews where Grant said, Lee was a man who needed sunshine. And he felt that Lee got sunshine, you know, on the Confederate side. And what Grant meant by that was he felt that one of the advantages that the Confederacy had was that there was much greater political unity, so that there was, you know, this almost kind of uncritical adoration of Lee. Grant felt, again, in terms of the political environment of the war, that he was operating in a much more complicated situation because there was a very large Copperhead element in Copperhead Press in the North, Copperhead Press being, you know, people who were opposed to the war, wanted a negotiated peace or even were sympathetic to the South. And so Grant felt that the political divisions in the North were much deeper than the political divisions in the South. And what that meant was that generals like Grant had to put up with much, much more criticism in the press. And he felt that Robert E. Lee kind of thrived on all of this adoration in the Confederate press. And you could see there's almost a slight envy that he had, you know, that that Lee enjoyed that. And clearly the Northern generals did.
And Lee was 6 feet tall and man of stature, and Grant was...
Grant was about 5'8". And depending upon the period, you know, it was described as either slight or stout.
Yeah. And didn't care whether his clothes were rumpled or clean or
No. Grant was always kind of slovenly. I got very, very interested. It's hard not to, writing biography of Ulysses Grant. I got very interested in Robert E. Lee as well because, you know, the stories I was told about Lee. That when the Civil War broke out, you know, he was about 15 years older than Grant. Grant had graduated around the middle of his class at West Point. Robert E. Lee had graduated second in his class. But the story is always told that when the Civil War broke out, that Robert E. Lee was offered command of the Union Army and decided to go, you know, back to his home in Virginia out of a sense of loyalty to his native state. And the story is very often told in almost kind of sentimental terms. I'm not saying there's not an element of truth to it, because there clearly is. But what I discovered, you know, the more deeply that I delved into Lee's life and views, he was a true believer in the Confederacy, not just in, you know, defending his native states. He said, we had sacred principles maintained, and then sacred principles were preservation of slavery. And I came upon a lot of things, you know, that he said about slavery that were really shocking.
Yeah.
That Lee said that the slaves, for instance, were measurably better off in the American South than they had been in Africa. And he said the African race, that they were undergoing a painful discipline, slavery, but that this is needed to bring them to kind of a higher level of instruction. And even after the Civil War, he signed this manifesto saying that the kindness of slavery should be restored. Very hard to kind of imagine, you know. And also said he wrote in one letter. He said, "I notice wherever the black people are, things are always getting worse and worse, and wherever white people are, things are getting better and better." So this was really, I think that it's been very much underestimated, the extent to which he subscribed to the theology of the Confederacy. He was fighting more than just to defend his native state.
Yeah. I don't want to dwell too much on the Civil War because the presidency is so important, but I do have two questions about that. One is, what was it? Lincoln went through four generals or more who were incompetent, McClellan, Joe Hooker, et cetera. Grant came in and was different. What was different about Grant?
Yeah, I think what it was with Grant is that up until the time in March 1864, Grant is winning one battle after another in the West. You know, it's funny, if you kind of see a documentary or you kind of read a book about the Civil War, and if it's just focusing on Virginia, it seems like one Union disaster after another. But if you look at what was going on in the West, Grant at Fort Donelson, you know, in Vicksburg, in Chattanooga, you know, et cetera, Grant is winning one victory after another. Finally, in 1864, he becomes the general-in-chief. I think had it not been for the rumor mill about the drinking, he would have been brought, you know, east sooner as general-in-chief. You know, and it was really Grant who was the strategic genius of the war, because what he saw was that the various Union armies in the different theaters of war had been operating independently of one another. So he kind of really comes up with a master plan so that all of the various Union armies, you know, their movements will be coordinated. He was able to do this through his mastery of the telegraph and the railroad. Very significant. When Grant fought in the Mexican War, he was a quartermaster by background and training, which meant that he had an immense sense of logistics. Sherman had a wonderful line. He said that Grant's strategy encompassed an entire continent. He said Robert E. Lee's strategy encompassed one small state. So Grant has this kind of spacious vision. And so during that last year of the war, when Grant is general-in-chief, everything that is going on relates to everything else that is going on. So Sherman may be marching to the sea, but one reason Sherman succeeds is that Grant has Robert E. Lee pinned down, you know, in Virginia and can't assist him. That's just kind of one small, you know, example of what was going on and the way that Grant actually masterminded, you know, this coordination of all of the different Union armies. Also, you know, when Sherman was asked about Grant's genius as general, because he did think that Grant was the great general produced by the war, Sherman pointed to the fact of Grant's simple faith in success. He said every battle they'd fought together, Grant was convinced that they were going to win. And Sherman said, I can only liken Grant's simple faith in success in battle to a Christian's faith in his Savior. And this was something that communicated itself to the men, that there was this quiet the determination.
Because they were used to fighting a battle and then retreating back across the Rapidanic.
Yeah, there's a great moment in the story. I actually had thought at one point of opening the book with him that, you know, when he takes over, you know, the Army, he makes his headquarters in the field with the Army of the Potomac, and they cross the Rapidan River at the beginning of the so-called Overland campaign. And this is the first time he's really in charge of the Army of the Potomac, and there had been a series, you know, of generals going back to McDowell McClellan and you know, Pope and Burnside, Hooker, you know, Meade. They'd all, you know, failed to destroy Lee's army. So after the first battle is a very, very bloody two-day battle at the Wilderness. And Grant was very, very secretive as general. That is, he would not even reveal to his top commanders what his next move was. He would just say things like, the army is moving out tonight, you know, and everyone would get ready. And they were really not sure, you know, what the master plan was. And after the two-day battle of the Wilderness, you know, that night, he tells his commanders to have, you know, the troops ready to move out that night. And the troops start moving. And the troops had been so accustomed under all of the previous generals that after a defeat, you know, they would slink back towards Washington, D.C., licking their wounds in defeat. And what happens, you know, the soldiers first, they kind of march east, and then they're all expecting to turn left, in other words, north towards Washington. Instead, this entire massive army starts wheeling around to the south. In other words, after this very bloody battle, they're moving on to Richmond. Yeah, and this great cheer goes up, and Grant, you know, on horseback, shadowy figure, comes barreling down the road, and there are these tremendous cheers. Grant was actually, you know, worried that the cheering would tip off, you know, Lee to the movement of the army. But it was a sort of very quiet way that he would radiate confidence in the outcome of individual battles and the war. And, you know, one of Grant's famous lines, the two-day battle of Shiloh, the first day was really a disaster for the Union Army. They were thrown back against the Tennessee River, you know, and that night, Grant walks up the hill. It was raining, so he thought he would take refuge in a farmhouse, but the farmhouse has been converted into a field hospital. And a field hospital in the Civil War, the night after a battle, essentially the surgeons sawing, you know, amputating limbs. Grant sees all, you know, the blood and the amputated limbs, and even though he was derided as a butcher, he was very sensitive, very squeamish. So he goes back out into the rain, and he decides that he's just going to sleep outdoors under the spreading branches of this tree. And he's standing there with the rain, you know, dripping down the brim of his hat, and Sherman comes over to him and says, "Grant, we've had the devil's own day, but haven't we?" And Grant looks at Sherman and says, "Lick him tomorrow." And I don't think that there's any other general in the Civil War at that stage of the war would have at that point said, "We go on the offensive."
On the northern.
Yeah, and in fact, Grant said, you know, Grant saw a pattern in his battles. He said the Confederates very often won the first day. There would be this kind of, you know, Confederate pluck and gallantry. And then the second day, Grant's sheer determination and will to win would begin to mow them down. And he felt that the Confederates often had the advantage the first day, but the second and third day were always his, you know, and he won, and he was right.
Yeah, and he, you know, what comes through here is his instinctive genius for field maneuvers, tactics, strategy, people, everything. The other part of the Civil War I want to go into, and I don't want to wear this joke out, but if there were a "In the Room Where It Happened" that came out of this book, to me that would be the Appomattox Courthouse.
Yeah, well, you know, it's very interesting because at Appomattox Courthouse, and mind you, this was the third Confederate army that Grant had captured. It's very interesting. Grant captured, you know, 1862, Confederate Army at Fort Donelson in Tennessee. 1863, captures the Confederate Army at Vicksburg, and then most famously captures Lee's army at Appomattox Courthouse in 1865. So Grant captures three entire Confederate armies. Robert E. Lee never captured a single Union army.
Right. But
what happens at Appomattox Courthouse is politically very, very important. Grant, as you all know the story, was very magnanimous. The Confederate soldiers were really starving by that point, and he immediately distributes 25,000 rations to them. He allows the ordinary soldiers to keep their horses and mules. He allows the Confederate officers to keep their sidearms. And I think, very importantly, Grant refuses to allow the Union soldiers to either gloat or celebrate over this. In fact, Julia Grant, after the fall of Richmond, you know, had said to her husband that he should enter Richmond, which had been the capital of the Confederacy. And Grant turns to Julia and says, "Julia, don't you realize how bitterly they are experiencing defeat? And why should I add to their misery at such a moment?" So Grant, believe it or not, never entered Richmond. Lincoln, you all know the story. Lincoln did enter Richmond immediately afterwards. And Grant went so far in terms of not wanting to humiliate the South that after the war, when there was a proposal to do a big historical painting to hang in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol of Lee surrendering to Grant, Grant refused to allow that.
Yeah.
Because he felt that it would humiliate the South. And, you know, so Grant becomes the great figure of North-South reconciliation at Appomattox. And I wish that was the end of the story, but you know that it wasn't. Yeah.
Right.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Well, what Grant says about that, I think, is so telling about his character, and I marked it, and I think it would be worth reading, because these are Grant's own words about that. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, this is a beautiful passage from the Personal Memoirs of You. This is, as Grant, maybe the most famous passage. What General Lee's feelings were, I do not know. As he was a man of much dignity, with an impassible face, it was impossible to say whether he felt inwardly glad that the end had finally come, or felt sad over the result and was too manly to show it. Whatever his feelings, they were entirely concealed from my observation. But my own feelings, which had been quite jubilant on the receipt of his letter, announcing that he wanted to surrender, were sad and depressed. I felt like anything rather than rejoicing at the downfall of a foe who had fought so long and valiantly and had suffered so much for a cause, though that cause was, I believe, one of the worst for which a people ever fought and one for which there was the least excuse. Well, that's not only beautifully written, but, you know, that formulation of simultaneously acknowledging the valor of the Confederate troops, at the same time saying that this was a completely misguided thing. And then, you know, it's very interesting. Part of the agreement at Appomattox, very important part, and less emphasized, is that Grant promises Robert E. Lee that he and the other Confederate generals will not be prosecuted for treason after the war. Now, Grant did this even though he thought that they had committed treason. He felt this very strongly. But Grant felt that they could never have ended the war at that point if the Confederate generals felt that they were going to be prosecuted for treason after the war. Anyway, what happens, and this was probably about 6 weeks after Appomattox, there's a grand jury in Norfolk, Virginia, that indeed wants to indict for treason not just Lee, but James Longstreet and Joseph Johnston. In other words, kind of the main Confederate generals. Well, what happens is, and Lee was thunderstruck. Lee, you know, contacts Grant and said, I thought you promised at Appomattox Courthouse that there would be no treason prosecution. And Lee was right. Grant goes to President Andrew Johnson, who succeeded Lincoln after the assassination. And Johnson, at that point, he changes his view afterwards. At that point, Andrew Johnson is saying treason is odious. He's on the warpath for revenge. And Grant goes to the White House and says to Johnson, you have to squash this treason indictment because I promised Lee that he wouldn't be indicted. That promise was backed up by Abraham Lincoln. And the war, in Grant's estimation, would have gone on for another year without that promise. Johnson doesn't want to go along with that. He wants to prosecute. And then Grant finally has to kind of play, you know, his
lawyer.
I'd say trump card these days. Grant finally has to say to him that he will resign. He was still general in chief, that he would resign if there was a treason prosecution. And at that point, President Johnson did indeed give orders that the treason prosecutions would be quashed. So Grant saved saved Lee. But, you know, it was kind of, as I think about it, it was a very mixed blessing because maybe what we needed after the Civil War was a kind of truth and reconciliation process of actually confronting what had happened and the reality that the South, you know, had fought to preserve slavery. And I think that it's one reason that there still is a lot of unfinished business in this country surrounding the Civil War, because there was never that kind of confrontation, legal and moral and political confrontation, with what had really happened. And then there was a whole school of thought that began to dominate the South. It's kind of known as the Lost Cause. And the Lost Cause, and this started right after the war, the Lost Cause began to essentially rewrite history. It began to romanticize the Confederacy. The tenets of the Lost Cause was that the slaves were really happy and contented. The slaves resented the abolitionists. The Lost Cause school said that the war was not over slavery, it was over states' rights. Lost Cause school said the greater general was Robert E. Lee. Grant was just a brutal butcher. And then, you know, as Reconstruction went on, the Lost Cause school said that Reconstruction was not a noble experiment in trying to create a fully biracial society. What was this terrible fiasco of corrupt carpetbag politicians from the North and illiterate black legislatures. And these all became very, you know, incorporated into Southern dogma. And in fact, this was the political backdrop to all of these Confederate monuments that started going up around 1875, in other words, towards the end of Grant's second term as president. So as Faulkner said, you know, the past is never past. We're actually still living with these two competing narratives of what happened.
Well, that's an interesting thing, because Lincoln had certainly set the tone with his second inaugural, so Grant was just picking that up. You've taken us nicely to Grant as president, because Reconstruction was obviously one of his biggest things. So let's go to that phase of his life.
Yeah, because I think particularly, as I was saying earlier, you know, people associate his presidency with the scandals and nepotism. And those things happen. I go into them in great length in the book. I'm not trying to excuse them. But Grant was not personally involved in the scandals. Actually, he insisted that the scandals be vigorously prosecuted. But what I try to show in the book is that even though, you know, those scandals have defined the historic stereotype of Grant's presidency, the big story, far and away the big story, is what Grant did to protect the 4 million former slaves who, by the 13th Amendment, slavery was abolished. By the 14th Amendment, they're given full citizenship rights. And by the 15th Amendment, most significantly, they're given the right to vote. And by the time Grant becomes president, there is a terrible, violent reaction going on in the South in the form of the Ku Klux Klan. Let me just sketch in a little background on the Klan. Because the Klan starts in 1866 in a place called Pulaski, Tennessee. It starts out innocuously enough as a kind of social club for Confederate veterans. They then to assume the character of a militia, you know, and within a year or two, the Klan has spread throughout the South, and the Klan begins to, at night, don hoods and robes and go out on horseback and terrorize the black community, because the black community was voting in great numbers. It's kind of very impressive, you know, they had just gotten the vote, and in many Southern counties, black participation rates, 70% of blacks turning out, 90% of blacks turning out. This was sort of due credit to us today to have those kinds of, you know, voting rates in the electorate. And so blacks constituted more than a third of the Southern population. In states like South Carolina and Mississippi, actually a majority of the population, which meant that if the blacks dared to exercise their right to vote, that they would actually have significant power, maybe even controlling power. So the Klan begins a reign of terror, and not tens, not hundreds, but thousands. I emphasize, thousands of blacks were murdered in the South without a single prosecution. There was no Southern jury that would convict a member of the Klan. There was no Southern white who would testify against a member of the Klan. There was no Southern sheriff who would dare to arrest a member of the Klan. Ulysses S. Grant, the Justice Department, was created during his first term as president. Grant was the moving force behind something called the Ku Klux Act that gave him power to declare martial law, suspend habeas corpus, and he appoints a crusading attorney general from Georgia named Damus Ackerman. And under Grant, the Justice Department brings 3,000 indictments against the Ku Klux Klan. There were more than 1,000 convictions. And as Frederick Douglass said, the slaughter and scourging of my people have ceased. This is such an enormous thing, so much more important than, you know, the scandals, which again did not involve Grant. And yet it's become a forgotten chapter of American history and required a lot of courage, because Grant not only had to do this in the teeth, obviously, of massive resistance from the white South, but during his two-term presidency, there's a shrinking base in the North where there's a lot of racism. And interestingly enough, it was kind of the liberal wing of the Republican Party that began to retreat from Reconstruction, so that Grant is kind of fighting a battle on two fronts, most obviously against white Democrats in the South, but also against, you know, with his own shrinking Republican base. And I just think it's one of the most courageous, you know, and far-sighted things that any American president has done. And, you know, unfortunately, there's been a kind of complete amnesia about it.
Yeah. And that's where, for example, Horace Greeley comes in on his at the second term election, right?
Yeah, I love Grant's line about Horace Greeley. He said Horace Greeley, who was the editor of the New York Tribune, he said Horace Greeley was a genius without common sense. He had a kind of delightful dry, but Grant's also, you know, kind of a great adversary during this period was Charles Sumner, who was the imperious head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And Sumner was terrific in terms of abolition, but boy, I mean, he was a very egotistical and difficult character. And Grant had a couple of priceless lines about Charles Sumner. He was once asked if he had ever heard Sumner converse, and he said, no, but I've heard him lecture. he once was told that Sumner did not believe in the Bible, and Grant said, of course not, he didn't write it. But it was interesting when, Grant was two-term president. Actually, he was the only two-term president between Andrew Jackson and Woodrow Wilson. So he became a very, very adroit politician. But again, to give you a little bit of the flavor of the politics of the period, because this white supremacy business has always been with us.
Yeah, and
it's not new.
And he, I mean, I just reinforcing what you said, he used every tool in his toolkit that he could as president to try to stop this. But
absolutely, you know, I mean, this was a powerful. In 1868, his first election, he runs against a man named Horatio Seymour, who was governor of New York. And the platform of the Democratic Party in 1868 was, this is a white man's government.
Yeah,
Andrew Johnson, who was president preceding Grant. Grant, as president, he said, this is a white man's government, and God damn it, as long as I'm president, the white man will rule. I mean, this was out in the open. And that when, you know, Horace Greeley ran against Grant in 1872, Greeley said, you know, we have to kind of shake hands with the South across the bloody chasm.
Right.
That was, you know, his big line. And so, and, you know, one thing that I was very, very fascinated, there's a four-year period between the end of the Civil War and the beginning of Grant's presidency. When he still is general-in-chief, he's even acting Secretary of War in there. And these are very, very important years also. Because what I discovered was that there was a civil rights movement in the South that, again, has been completely, completely forgotten. In 1867, the radical Republicans in Congress, the First Reconstruction Act divides the South into five military districts. The district in Louisiana and Texas, the commander was Phil Sheridan, whom you all know from the Civil War. Phil Sheridan, in 1867, writes a letter to Grant. Again, Grant is still the general-in-chief, so the five commanders are all reporting to him. 1867, Phil Sheridan writes Grant a letter from New Orleans that absolutely astounded me. Because he writes to Grant, he said, we desegregated streetcars in New Orleans this week. And he proceeds to tell the story that blacks and whites rode on separate streetcars. And he said that the black streetcars had a star on the side to identify them as black only, and then there were white only streetcars. He said that the blacks, in protest at this segregation, had begun to pour onto the white streetcars. the streetcar companies, wanting to maintain this segregation, then appeal to Sheridan. And Sheridan says to these streetcar companies, he said that if they don't integrate the streetcars, that they will not be able to operate.
Right.
And so then Sheridan writes very proudly to Grant. He said there was a little bit of a ruckus at first, you know, when I made this decision, but he said, I'm happy to report now that blacks and whites are riding side by side on streetcars in New Orleans. 1867, folks.
Wow.
And mind you, you all probably know the story of Rosa Parks.
Yeah.
This was 90 years before Sheridan is writing that many blacks are pouring onto the white streetcars. We don't know their names. And it wasn't just one person, right, you know, doing it. And so there was this entire civil rights movement budding in the South. We all know the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, but how many people know the Civil Rights Act of 1866, the Civil Rights Act of 1875, which banned desegregation in public accommodations and transportation and, you know, juries, etc. It's just so interesting what we as a country have decided to forget and to remember.
Yeah, that's, as you were talking, that's what was pounding out of my mouth was, why has, as a generalization, why have we kind of whited out the this period of history? Pardon the...
Yeah, I read recently, and I would highly recommend it, a beautiful book written by David Blight, historian at Yale, called Race and Reason. If you want to, in fact, get the whole backdrop to the Confederate monuments, it's a wonderful book. You know, and what he shows was that after the Civil War, in an attempt to create reconciliation, and there would be all of these events, like all of the veterans of Gettysburg, you know, both the blue and the gray, you know, they would meet and they would, you know, embrace. You know, and that was nice, and that was important that we heal as a country. It was important that we have reconciliation. But what he argues in the book, which I think was, you know, definitely true, was that that came at a price. And what the price was to, you know, de-emphasize emancipation and race relations and all of these different things, and to create a kind of false equivalency that there were brave, you know, Union soldiers and there were brave Confederate soldiers, and they would meet on these battlefields, you know, after the war and embrace again. And I think that it's one of the reasons why that there are so many Americans who... it's very impressive to me. There's so many Americans who know their Civil War battles in great detail, and they know all the maneuvers and the generals, and that's great. But I have been struck by how many people who have very detailed, impressively detailed knowledge of the Civil War know little or nothing about Reconstruction. And I feel it's kind of Civil War and Reconstruction were two acts of the same drama. Mm-hmm. And if you know everything about the Civil War and nothing about Reconstruction, it's a little bit like walking out in the middle of a play, and the play ends very differently from the way you would think if you just sat, you know, through the first two or three acts of a five-act drama.
And I would add that not understanding Reconstruction and its failure is a handicap to understanding our current problems.
Absolutely. You know, and you can't understand why... to this day, there's a solid South without understanding Reconstruction, because the solid South, you know, up until the time LBJ signed the Voting Rights Act, there was a solid Democratic South. You know, now we have a solid Republican South, but the South continues to function, you know, as an economic block. And it's really because, you know, during Reconstruction, Grant has to repeatedly send in federal troops in order to prevent massacres against black citizens. And the South raises the cry of bayonet rule and Caesarism. And, you know, so the South develops this rather extreme hostility toward federal action, raises the banner of states' rights, and really functions very much as a political unit. And that political culture still exists and, I think, you know, underlies a lot of what we still see to this day. The past is not past, as Mr. Faulkner said.
Right. And I'm going to start segueing into audience questions, and one of them is extremely timely to Grant's very enlightened attitude towards African Americans, and that was a question is regarding his attitude towards Native Americans.
That's a very good question, yeah, because it's an important part of the story. I perhaps concentrate more in the book on African Americans than Native Americans. But what happens when Grant becomes president, you know, he's to an unusual extent, he was very, very sympathetic towards the mistreatment of Native Americans. And I have quotes in the book, you know, Sheridan supposedly said, you know, no good Indian, but a dead Indian. Sherman writes to Sheridan, the more Indians we kill this year, the fewer we'll have to kill next year. I mean, there was a very, very bloodthirsty attitude from all these generals who'd fought in the Civil War. Grant, from the time that he was a young soldier posted in Northern California, actually he was at Fort Humboldt, which was up around Eureka.
Right.
And then also Vancouver Barracks across the river from Portland. And even at that, he wrote very sympathetically about Native Americans. He always said that Native Americans needed as much protection from the white man, you know, as vice versa. So he becomes president, and he says things, you know, in one speech, he said, I never could believe that the Lord put different races on the earth so that the stronger could exterminate the weaker. This is he was talking about Native Americans. So, I mean, kind of full of good intentions. He was friends with a man named Eli Parker, whom he had known in Galena, Illinois. He makes Eli Parker, who was a full-blooded Seneca sachem, he makes Eli Parker his first head of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, first commissioner of Indian Affairs. And there was a lot of corruption going on with the Indian reservations, with crooked government agents, you know, selling Indians shoddy goods or overpriced goods. Grant actually strikes a deal with the Quakers and replaces all these corrupt agents with Quaker agents because he felt that the Quakers had a good history with Native Americans. Unfortunately, the story ends badly.
Yeah.
The story ends very badly because ultimately, in spite of all of his good intentions, Grant believes that, as he said, you know, Indians should be Christianized and civilized, that they should go to reservations, they should speak English, they should become farmers. And for the Indians, this was kind of offering them a suicide pact for their culture. And then what happens, in the last analysis, Grant's constituency, the Western settlers, the mining companies, the railroads. Companies. I mean, there's just tremendous, you know, expansion going on across the country. And unfortunately, the story, I wish I could report that the ending was happier, but gold was found in the Black Hills, even though that area had been ceded to the Oglala Sioux. And so Grant's administration in July 1876, towards the close of his second term, Custer and his men are massacred at Little Bighorn. And what happened, you know, after that massacre was that a hue and cry went up, you know, in Congress and across the nation for revenge against Native Americans. So there was a tremendous, you know, increase in, you know, military forts and actions against Native Americans, and just a very punitive and vengeful action. So, you know, Grant's policy kind of paved with good intentions. Unfortunately, the road leads to a very bad place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and continues to. Another question that really ties into our narrative here is Grant ended his presidency extremely popular, his second term. In fact, I'll add that he almost ran for a third term. But
he tries.
And so he ends on this point of popularity, yet in 1948, Arthur Schlesinger published a list of presidents, and only Warren Harding was below Grant on the list.
Yeah, and what interestingly, so he's kind of next to the bottom in 1948. The most recent poll of presidential historians I saw placed him number 22, which means he was moved up from almost last to the middle of the pack, and I think that he's going to go higher. I think there's a, you know, in the stock market of historic reputations, yeah, it's a bull market. Buy grand shares at the moment, and so I think he's getting his due. And I was talking earlier about that Lost Cause school. Mm-hmm. That Lost Cause school also really glorified Lee. It denigrated Grant both as a general and as a president. And it's amazing how influential that was, not only in the South but in the North. And just to give a very simple illustration of that, it amazes me that to this day, the greatest Hollywood movie about the Civil War is Gone with the Wind, which completely reflects the Lost Cause view, and the mm-hmm. movie opens and all the slaves are happily singing in the fields and they're fussing over right. their masters. I mean, it's amazing that, you know, in many ways the North militarily won the war and then, you know, lost the subsequent peace. And so it's only, and it's not just my book, I mean, because there have been a number of books about Grant in recent years, good books. You know, we're all kind of coming out mm-hmm. with a much, much higher estimation of Grant. And again, I think that, you know, this reflects our values. It reflects our, I think, greater sensitivity on racial issues. What he did to protect mm-hmm. the African-American community of the South is no longer regarded as kind of minor story of his presidency, nor did Grant regard it as such. And I think that after Lincoln died, Grant had been tremendously influenced by Lincoln. He made a very interesting statement, because, you know, there were 1864, Lincoln had to run for re-election during the war. And Grant, you know, writes a letter and he says, I think that Lincoln's re-election is as important as anything going on in the battlefield. So I think that after Lincoln is assassinated and Grant said of Lincoln, he was incontestably the greatest man that I knew. I think that Grant takes the agenda, Lincoln's agenda of the war, preservation of the Union and emancipation, and I think that that really defines his agenda mm-hmm. for the rest of his life. He really gets religion on those issues, and Lincoln had an enormous influence on him.
Yeah, I love the phrase in the second inaugural, and the war came.
Yeah.
You know, like there's nobody at fault in the passive voice, and it seems as though Grant picked up where Lincoln left off in carrying that theme, but he doesn't get credit for that, or at least, I mean, go back to our whitehouse.gov summary of his presidency.
Yeah, and again, you know, Lincoln, you know, would that he had lived and dealt with this in terms of how Lincoln might have dealt with Reconstruction is a fascinating question. You know, Walt Whitman, another great statement about, you know, Grant and Reconstruction, he said Grant was faced with a problem of a peace as great as any problem mm-hmm. Of the war. And, you know, Lincoln, we all associate Second Inaugural, malice toward none, charity for all. And Grant, Lincoln says to Grant late in the war, he said, we don't want to be hanging the Confederates afterwards. We want to be hanging on to the Confederates afterwards. So he's talking in, you know, a very kind of liberal and humane and charitable way. But Lincoln felt tremendous responsibility for those 4 million slaves who suddenly were full-fledged American citizens. And it's absolutely impossible for me to imagine that Abraham Lincoln would somehow have been indifferent to the murder of thousands of African-American citizens after the war. And I think he would have done exactly what Grant you know, did, would have sent federal troops mm-hmm. into the South.
There's an excellent question, which is perhaps a way for us to wrap up, which is, what is the access to archives and information on Grant that may help future historians understand?
Well, that's a great question. You know, I just got an email just 3 days ago from Michelle Crowell, who's the head of the Civil War and Reconstruction at the Library of Congress. And she said to me, the Grant papers have now been digitized. They're online. His papers, you actually want to see the, you know, original documents online. He's just a click away, which is so extraordinary.
Where do you go? What's the link?
Yeah, I don't know. It's kind of HTTP. I don't.
Yeah.
I'll let you folks figure okay. that one out. Right.
Well, we'll just.
I'm not good at that. Yeah. You know, backslash. but one of the reasons that I decided to write the book was that between 1967 and 2012, an edition of Grant's papers, 32 thick volumes, were published. Mm-hmm. Before that, there had been no volume, not even a small edition of his papers. Those 32 volumes contained 50,000 documents, papers written by, to, or about Grant. There's something, it's now, believe it or not, at Mississippi State yeah. University, yeah. Ulysses S. Grant Presidential Library not only has those 50,000 documents, but another 200,000 documents. So I just realized that this was a scholarly feast, and that we know more about Ulysses than Julia knew at
right.
this point. That really, that the ideal materials were at hand, and I think that in earlier years Grant was not taken seriously enough, to kind of warrant the sort of editions that of papers that I worked with for yeah. Alexander Hamilton or George Washington. And I think that I feel like I and a number of recent historians. The editors of the U.S. Grant papers make us look very good. In fact, there's a man named John Y. Simon, who died a few years ago, who really was the moving force behind the Grant papers. And I wish he had lived long enough for me to meet him and thank him, because I feel like we're all, standing on his shoulders.
Yeah.
And if we see farther, it's because we have all these, unsung scholarly yeah. heroes in the background who don't get to sit on stages mm-hmm. like this, but they're kind of doing the quiet scholarly work that really forms the basis of all of these biographies.
And his personal memoirs are such a work of literature.
Yeah. And there's also the Grant Library down in Mississippi. They just published a wonderful, for the first time, an annotated edition of the memoirs, beautiful yeah. Book put out by Harvard University Press. So I'd love it if you read my book, but by all means go and read Grant's right. memoirs. If you've never read them, you're in for right. a great treat.
Well, read this book and then read Grant's memoirs. Well, okay, I'm so happy and appreciative of the fact you could be here and that you are contributing so much to our understanding of Washington, Hamilton, Grant, and whoever is next.
My great pleasure, and thank you for coming, folks.
Thank you so much. Yeah.